This episode is dedicated to Justin and Rachel. Happy anniversary, you two lovers. You were listening to The History of Religions and, of course, Their Gods. Oh, you're definitely going to need a tall boy, a 40-ounce Schlitz malt liquor, and a good hefty pair of goggles. Hello, heathens and history buffs, and welcome back to the big little show, The History of Religions and Their Gods podcast, hosted by me, yours truly, the skeptical ghost heathen. Otherwise, just James, if you guys want to call me James, or James Heathen. I don't care. It's all really good. But if you're still listening to my voice, if you're still paying attention to the show and enjoying the series, well, we're still in the series or season of 7, and now we're on episode 7. 7 episodes into this baby. And I'm titling this one, To Be Done with Sodom. There's good reasons for it, because we're going to be talking about the king's sacking of Sodom. Now, we're also going to talk about the historical Abraham. We're going to talk about his wife Sarah, and their sons Isaac and Ishmael, and this Mesopotamian overlord. And guys, I want to dig deep into the book of Genesis, especially chapters 12 all the way through 25, dissecting it. Dissecting what the original authors and the redactors are trying to hide, but what they also knew. And we're going to experience this covenant between this overlord and Abraham, and why it was so important. We talked about the trade routes already, but we're going to get a little bit deeper into that, and how a lot of that is hidden into other books as well. We're also going to talk about the birthright through the blood of this king to his son Isaac, and the threat imposed by his half-brother Ishmael. We will also spend some time talking about the king's sacking of the city Sodom, which is why I chose the title of this episode, To Be Done with Sodom. But guys, one thing's for sure, right? I mean, if it isn't funny, it doesn't make you laugh in your car, and if it isn't educational by some measure, and above all, blasphemous, then it just isn't worth it to me. So guys, if you're ready to blow up some cities, some ancient cities full of heathens, well then strap on your strap-ons, put on your goggles and your hard hat, and the lube, and let's go find Sodom. And on a side note, if you guys want to join a Facebook chat group that I put together called The History of Religions and Their Gods Podcast, there are about 20 people on there so far, including myself, talking about the episodes and some other random topics about the history of religions and other things. And also, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter or X, whatever you prefer, you can find me there as The Skeptical He1. All right, guys. Hope to talk to you out there soon. Hope you enjoy the episode. In this series, we have come to understand that there are no defining characteristics between the people who occupied the hill country and those who lived below it in the busy city ports of Canaan. They spoke and wrote in similar languages. So similar, the scholars have a very difficult time telling them apart. And they shared in the same religious cultic practices as well, such as burnt sacrifices to the gods, and same similar priesthoods dedicated to their respective deities, and which we have identified as the great Canaanite creator god El, the Lord Baal, or Sun, and Yahweh. and Ashira, the Queen Mother of Heaven, as late as the 18th century BCE. We also learned that these nomadic groups of people who settled in the high plains, along the coastal cities of Canaan, sometime along the 18th and 15th century BCE, they practiced the cult of the veneration of their dead ancestors, in order to keep their memory alive. Probably for the wonderful things that they did, and things that they'd done for them while they were alive, such as provide provisions, food, security, simply a place to call home, and a way of invasion, protection. These people would eventually turn into making idols in each of their memories, each of their names, their likeness, so they could easily remember them while traveling. Well, traversing through the desert plains, right? And in Ugaritic inscriptions, we can see that the Canaanites too deified their dead, just like their Egyptian neighbors did with their pharaohs. Now, the Egyptian neighbors, well, they had the ability and the manpower to build these massive monuments to their beloved kings. While Canaanites, too, they built temples, big ones, small ones, medium ones, little ones, and respective altars to their rulers that they also cared about. And we still have many of them today, mind you. Now, in the Ugaritic tradition, the king would be referred to as Baal in his earthly human manifestation, his flesh and blood state, if you would, which simply means Lord, and then typically followed by his earthly name, Baal Hadad, Baal Shaman, Baal of Tyre. And in most cases, after this king's death, he would be deified and worshipped at these temples dedicated to that respective Baal. And in other cases, one of these Baals would be elevated to the level of El, being the supreme god over all of Canaan, taking on all of his attributes and features, all the features of the god El in his divine manifestation. It's interesting to talk about that this specific Baal would be more than likely referred to as Baal-Yah. Baal-Yah. That's right. Because in Akkadian, it means Lord God. And Akkadian was the official spoken language of all the nations, of all the territories in the near far east, especially when it came down to treaties and covenants and agreements between kings and nations. We can also observe through the use of biblical texts that the divine name of El manifested in other ways as well, such as El Shaddai, which is basically a conjunction term. Obviously, El, being the deified king, and Shaddai, who is basically a fertility goddess in Shechem, the original home of the biblical patriarchs, where we find the Shechemite deities, being Baal-Berith, El-Berith, and the Shaddai fertility goddess. Then we also get the use in biblical texts the term Elohim, which you've heard a lot, we're going to talk a lot about as we go through Genesis here, but it's used in order to identify a couple of different ways, either gods, more than one god or a conjunction god, just like El Shaddai, which is a compound deity. And as we talked about, many scholars believe that El Shaddai together was actually a deified king, or Baal-Yah, and Asherah. Asherah, the feminine goddess, as the spelling is very similar, if not exactly the same, between Asherah and Shaddai. Some symbols missing are added. But the biblical authors also used Elohim to identify their dead ancestors. So whenever the writers for God, for Yahweh, the creator of the entire universe, is referring to Abraham and his Elohim, he's referring to the dead ancestors who will protect them as their El-Berith, or as the compound deity of El-Berith and Asherah, or otherwise, as we've learned, Abraham's Sarah, the Queen Mother of Heaven and Israel. Now, for sure, the original concept was probably one and the same as the deified El and the goddess, and would have been recognized as the LOM, because both terms actually fit quite perfectly. So as we go through this episode, we need to ask ourselves, why would anybody think, from layman to scholar, that the nomadic tribes had settled in the highlands with their Egyptian and Canaanite neighbors for centuries, if not a millennia, would be any different from their practices? Because we've already observed, guys, just how closely they are related, how closely they're tied together in every single aspect, from religious cultic practices to language to art to burial practices to temple priestly responsibilities. We have to conclude that they were no different at all. That's why we see so much confusion in the earliest biblical texts, where even the authors struggle to identify this anthropomorphic figure, this anthropomorphic king, versus the God of the entire universe. Now, it has been known for a very long time in Old Testament studies that in the Abrahamic narratives, the Yahweh character seems to exhibit a predominantly anthropomorphic figure or character, meaning he's meeting with people in tents. He's having discussions while hanging out on earth. He's wrestling with Jacob, holding large council meetings, while Elohim, on the other hand, exhibits more of an immaterial character, meaning he's more like a ghost or a celestial being. Despite many verses also showing Elohim speaking and interacting with Abraham as well. So what do we do with this? Freaking scribes can't make up your mind how to depict this guy. But therefore, just as there are two names in the text for our hero, there are also two different natures for him. One wrestling with people and the other only existing in the heavenly realms. In fact, it is because of this, along with many other similar observations, that led to the scholar and author Wellhausen to develop his hypothesis in the first place, that Yahweh was, in fact, a deified ancestor, a human being, only to later take on traits of the deity after his death. However, Wellhausen firmly believed that Yahweh and Elohim referred to one and the same, versus being two different characters entirely. Just like we talked about before, such as Baal Berith in his anthropomorphic human and blood state, and El Berith in his immaterial heavenly divine state. Now, reflecting on the various polemical statements found in the biblical text, especially concerning the identification of Yahweh as Israel's Elohim, well, some scholars, such as Goldstein, well, he suggests that the term Elohim actually came to be associated with Yahweh, not without some resistance that the term Elohim came to be associated with Yahweh. He says, "We believe that this identification was disputed and not necessarily taken for granted in ancient Israel." But instead of following the conventional theory that basically suggests the Abrahamic narratives were created by redactors and authors who were combining separate documents or fragments, are oral traditions that had a mixture of anthropomorphic as well as immaterial characteristics, and writing centuries later and trying to put it all together. That makes sense, because wouldn't it also be reasonable to consider that the possibility is that the original story featured two distinct figures, one an anthropomorphic one and the other an immaterial one, just like Baal Berith and El Berith? Because why would there be two accounts for this deity? That just seems strange. El Shaddai, if you want to make three. But why would these ancient writers, these redactors, place their deity on earth doing physical things? Unless there was an understanding of this deity that was similar to the Ugaritic and the Egyptian and the Babylonian understanding, where their deities did walk on earth and rule at one time. So whether the separate documents or the oral traditions, or perhaps just the fragments that these guys had, these redactors had, that featured the same deity and they were just woven together during an editorial process, which is what scholars refer to as the documentary hypothesis. Basically what we see in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, why Adam has two wives and the arrangement and the order of creation is off and different a little bit. Or we also have the idea of two original figures that were conflated in the psyche of the Israelites over time, which is what we call the deified Lord hypothesis. The end result would be the same as any distinction that ever existed between Yahweh and Elohim, and would eventually disappear. Now, while Wellhausen's assumption is still the leading hypothesis today, faced with two reasonable possibilities, the scientific method invites us to diligently evaluate and compare which of the two best accounts for the available evidence that better supports the history as we know it so far. Well, folks, given what we just talked about, can we or should we still trust the terms Yahweh and Elohim as they appear in the biblical text today? Because we know for sure that the scribal errors, the transcription errors, did in fact occur. And it seems that some scribes and copyists actually favor the use of one name over the other. That being, hey, I like Elohim, versus using Yahweh in this statement. And we can still spot a few of these lingering discrepancies between the various translations of the Bible, where the terms have actually been just swapped out. Such as what we find in the King James Version from the 16th century, after centuries of editing. Or the Qumran scrolls that are 1,600 years older than King James Version. And who knows what the originals once said 1,000 years before that? So if these substitutions had no impact, would the editors and or the original authors were adopting a theological perspective, where Yahweh and Elohim are perceived as one and the same entity, they do accumulate, and they do contribute to some increased confusion in the context of the exegesis, where each figure seems to play a different role in the story. Isn't that strange? They may swap, but they're definitely playing a different distinctive role in the story. Therefore, despite the extreme transcriptional care taken by the copyist, a detailed analysis of the Abrahamic narrative should lead us to conclude that the names Yahweh and Elohim have occasionally been substituted out with one or the other, accidentally, and over hundreds of years by scribal interpretations. So guys, we have to ask ourselves then, can we still detect and correct these potential substitutions in order to restore the text back to the original author's terms, who he or she thought the titles were actually intended for? So I don't know if this is going to be easy or not, folks. I mean, this is up to our author here, Lambarell. But how can one steer towards the original author's intent rather than stray away from it? Well, the only way to do this is through an objective measure that would be needed in order to avoid any digression whatsoever. But which one? Because the nature of the relationship between Yahweh and or Elohim and Abraham, it actually will help us fix these discrepancies. Because we're going to look at the relationship between Yahweh and Abraham and Elohim and Abraham and the roles that they play. We're going to weigh it out. So what we're going to do here is, instead of relying on the term that the last copyist just wedged into place, we should revisit the text or the narrative and insert the term that would best fit the context of the story. So for example, when encountering an earthly relationship where it appears that the Lord is speaking directly to Abraham, we should be using the term Lord or Yahweh. And in contrast, we should be using God or Elohim as the title whenever Abraham is found praying or worshiping to a celestial or immaterial deity, right? Now, on the other hand, we have several other verses that provide even better insight into the origins of the confusion, that being the use of the two terms. Now, in this passage that I'm about to read, Yahweh is perceived as an Elohim, which can be and should be construed as either a compound deity or a dead ancestor, but also in the celestial meaning, right? Now, in Genesis 28:21, it reads like this. so that I come again to my father's house in peace. Then shall the Lord be my Elohim. Now the patriarchs implicitly acknowledge a divine dimension here. A divine dimension to their overlord. Perhaps even a deified ancestor, I'm guessing. And finally, there are some verses where the context is even more ambiguous and could support either an earthly or an immaterial relationship between Abraham and this deity, right? But in these cases, we have to examine the wider context in order to determine the most appropriate term to use. So we're going to do a little exercise here. Now, here's one example of this kind of ambiguity that I'm talking about, and it's found in Genesis 24:56, and it reads like this. And he said unto them, Hinder me not, seeing the Lord hath prospered my way. Send me away, that I may go to my master. Now in this verse, the term Lord could refer to an earthly overlord, or an immaterial deity as well, making the context go virtually left or right, either way. And while these terms are used appropriately in the majority of the cases, well, it appears that a number of substitutions have nevertheless made their way right into the text over time by subsequent redactors over centuries. So I think that a textual analysis of the story of Abraham will reveal the passages in which the term Yahweh and Elohim would have been substituted. That's what we're going to try to conquer today. Now, you guys tell me what you think in the notes or in the emails on TikTok or Twitter or wherever we are. But because if we look at Genesis chapters 12 all the way through 25, we can see that there is an imbalance between the terms being used to identify the human anthropomorphic character or a divine ghostly character or a completely ambiguous character. The identification of Yahweh in these chapters is an astounding. Tell me how many you think, what the percentage is of the anthropomorphic figure represented in these chapters. An entire 90% of this figure from 13 chapters, is an anthropomorphic figure, meaning the character in the story is exhibiting human-like behavior. Now the remaining 10%, it's either celestial or ambiguous. Now that's pretty huge, right? So why did these editors over time start morphing this human-like figure into a ghostly figure floating around on a big celestial cloud with pearly gates and golden paved roads? Was it the same situation where the biblical Baals were worshipped by men in a ghostly, spiritual, and celestial, and godlike sense? Where in Ugaritic inscriptions, Baal is both understood as human and divine, only to be elevated to El or Elohim. Because in the Shishamite inscriptions, Baal would be represented by the biblical Lord, or Yahweh, and El. El would naturally represent the biblical Elohim. Or if you prefer, folks, Baal Berith, and ultimately El Berith. Now we get a similar response when we look at every time the term Elohim is used in these chapters. At least 50% of the time, this identification is still anthropomorphic, where about 40% of the time it's used in a celestial sense, and about 10% is ambiguous that it could go either way. So this proves without a shadow of a doubt that the character Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible has undergone several substitutions over a millennia, while Elohim has gone through even more. However, it's unclear whether glosses, commentaries, or periscopes, or even entire chapters were added over time to reflect a particular theological viewpoint, or to repair damaged inscriptions, or maybe even to enhance the story with oral traditions that the scribe was maybe aware of, or simply the message that was enforced by the priesthood that they wanted to enforce. Or perhaps the original scribes were developing Yahweh and Elohim off the Shishamite deities and later scribes attempting to navigate around it. But all of these redactions, All of these layers of redactions over time, over centuries, seem to have affected many sections of the text that are mostly anecdotal and don't even advance the plot in any shape or form in any way. So why even bother? But if we're going to try to reconstruct and try to correct these lost original sentiments of the writers who are trying to tell a story that was in circulation around the 12th century BCE, guys, we would find that both Yahweh and Elohim would be closer to a 90% flesh and blood shitting God. That's right, a 90% anthropomorphic figure in Genesis 12 to 22. So if these suspected redactions, these redaction layers, if you would, if they can be identified and excluded out, although subjectivity obviously plays a significant role here, well, the result would become even clearer, that we can see that the majority of the time, that the majority of the substitutions impact the term Elohim, which is used in situations where one would anticipate Yahweh to be thrown in. Now, according to Bernard Lambarelle, the one whose book we're following along here, by using a probability analysis, we can objectively evaluate the likelihood that Yahweh was always meant to be an anthropomorphic figure in Genesis. And this can be achieved by comparing the text at hand with what would be random results. So for instance, if the term Yahweh and Elohim had been used totally interchangeably, well, the probability of finding Yahweh associated with an anthropomorphic figure should be like what? Like 50%, right? We're just randomly throwing it out there, using the flip of the coin theory, that is. Of course, in real life, an author has his or her own motivations, their own inspirations when it comes to framing a name. And we cannot pretend to know why this person would do that, especially some 3,500 years ago. But because of this, we really should not expect random use of the titles and names, especially when we're talking about the God of the entire universe. But what we do need to do is look for any potential correlation between the use of the name Yahweh or Elohim and the nature of the figure that appears in the text, whether it's an anthropomorphic or a celestial being in the story. Now, when we look at the probability of Yahweh being referred to as an anthropomorphic figure and Elohim as an immaterial figure, well, we are looking for intention by the author, and any significant deviation from the intention would appear as random and would naturally imply some authorial interplay, whatever it may be, guys. So when we survey the frequency of each term being used in the text and its contextual use, it should shed some light on what the intentions were at the time. Now, in chapters 12 to 22 of Genesis, we can identify, or Bernard Lambarelle, I'll give him the credit, he identified that there are 66 occurrences where the author or authors and editors used the term Yahweh and Elohim, with Elohim being used 25 times, and Yahweh being used 41 times out of the 66. Now, when we examine the context of the literature in which the 66 terms appear, we can see that they are all used in an immaterial sense 11 times, and in a flesh and blood sense 55 times. It's also worth noting that when the nature of a particular occurrence was unclear or vague by the author, well, Bernard Lambarelle analyzed the surrounding context in order to make a better determination. Assuming that Elohim and Yahweh were used interchangeably or randomly, well, the probability of Elohim appearing in the immaterial context would be somewhere around 7%. While the probability of Yahweh appearing in the anthropomorphic context would be around a huge 51%. So by analyzing the surrounding context of the story, the figures both still prevail as being an anthropomorphic flesh and blood shit-and-eating machine in the ambiguous texts. We can also observe the frequency of errors in Genesis 12 to 22. It's much lower. Specifically, Elohim is used as an improper anthropomorphic context in only 24%. That's 16 out of the 66 occurrences, which is still more than half of the 25 times it appears, which is 64%, or 16 out of the 25. But in contrast, Yahweh is used in an improper, immaterial context in only 5%, being 3 out of the 66 of all the occurrences, which is less than 7%. 3 out of the 41, right? Now, despite appearing less frequently in the text, Elohim is associated with the majority of the errors occurring 5 times more greater than that of the Yahweh term. Now, I think because of this, it suggests that there was a preferential bias for the name Elohim among the later redactors, who may have intentionally, purposefully, or unintentionally, or accidentally substituted Yahweh with Elohim in the text. This is consistent with other known biases towards the name Elohim in the Bible as well, such as the known suspected replacement of Yahweh with Elohim in the Elohistic Psalter. That would be Psalms chapters 42 through 83. But the real errors are those that resulted from accidental transcriptions instead of purposeful substitutions for a preferred name, are likely to be instances where Yahweh appears instead of Elohim. And the extremely low rate of 5%, which is 3 times out of the total 66 times, indicates that the original material was meticulously preserved, despite the numerous transcriptions that the text underwent for almost 3,500 years. Now, guys, this is a testament to the historical accuracy of the narrative and the unwavering commitment to maintaining its authenticity. Now, despite the loose use of the term Elohim in the text by the scribes, we still find a correlation in 72% of all the occurrences. And furthermore, the odds that Yahweh refers to an anthropomorphic figure are extremely high, at 38 occurrences to 3. Now, you betting guys out there, you ready to lay out some cash again like we did last time? Because those odds are 13 to 1, fellas, 13 to 1. And ladies, too. But these findings, guys, they give us reasonable level of confidence that the use of the term Yahweh in Genesis 12 to 22 was not random at all, but was intentionally associated with an anthropomorphic figure. These observations may not be enough to conclude that Yahweh and Elohim were likely referring to a separate entity in the original text rather than one, but they do suggest that a secular exegesis of the text is warranted, and it opens up the door for further inquiry into the use of these terms and their significance in the narrative. Now, when it comes down to talking about anthropomorphic figures in the Bible, I like to look at some of the oldest Jewish literature, the Book of Job, verse 1 and 2. And Book of Job is written sometime around the 7th century BCE, sometime before the exile. And the first chapter opens like this, where we have a few anthropomorphic angelic figures having a little chat. And it goes like this. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared the Lord and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all of the people of the East. Now his sons, they used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. And early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed the Lord's in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels, or generals, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan, literally the one who challenges, also came with them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Hey, where have you been?" And Satan answered the Lord, his king, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." So basically, traveling the world, evidently on foot or camel, I suppose. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth quite like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears me and shuns evil, being you. Then Satan replied, Does Job fear you for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? Basically, a wall or a fortress in protection. You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. Implying the king has provided Job, or the Israelites in general, security, land, and protection. But now you stretch out your hand and you strike everything that he has? He will surely curse you to your face, said Satan. But the Lord said to Satan, Very well then, everything he has is now in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and he literally walked away. So in this scene, we literally have the Lord standing along with his angels, and I doubt that the original term was angels, it was probably messengers, or generals, or commanders, or elite. And they came to present themselves to this Lord, and then we have Satan. Now, for those of you who don't know, the Hallel, or Helale, or HaShatan, has literally always been just the one who challenges the Jews of their faith. It's always been that. It has never been a character. That did never come until Hellenistic Judaism, sometime in the close to the 3rd century BCE, and even closer to the 160s during the Maccabean period. So keep that in mind. The Satan in the story is just the challenge to the people of the Lord. And also we get this Satan, this challenger, having a conversation with the Lord, saying that, are you sure I'm going to be able to actually have access to Job or access to his animals and access to his things? Because you've provided him. You provided him with shelter. You provided him with mass quantities of land to where all of his animals, and there's quite a substantial amount of animals in the story, that could roam freely for miles. And then one day Job's sons and daughters, they were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house. And then a messenger came into Job and he said, The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby. And the Sabians, well, they came in and they attacked and they made off with all of the animals. And then they put the servants to the sword. They killed every single one of them. And I am the only one who survived and was able to escape to tell you. So interestingly enough, here is part of the test. Because without the Lord's protection, a group of marauders who were well known to frequent the trade routes stole Job's cattle and murdered his workers. In this ancient story, Satan cast a doubt on the Israelites for doubting their Lord's protection and his power over the entire land. And then the story continues. Now while the messenger was still speaking, another messenger came in and said, The fire of the Lord fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. Now, in this instance, the Lord character has switched to having storm and weather traits, like the Canaanite Baal and El. Now, this may have been introduced a little bit later, as it's still consistent with what we're talking about, but the difference between Yahweh and the Elohim. But while he was speaking, another messenger came in and said, The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties, and they swept down on your camels and made off with them. They also put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who was able to escape to tell you. Now, just like the Sabians before with the other messenger, they were roaming tribesmen from southern Mesopotamia who also frequented the trade routes. Now, this author is clearly demonstrating that every border will be compromised by foreign invasion without his control and support. And it continues. And while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came in and said, Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the older brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and it struck all four corners of his house. It collapsed on them and now they're all dead and I am the only one who has escaped to be able to tell you. Now at this, Job got up and tore his robe and he shaved his head bald. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I come from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taketh away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all of this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. So in this 6th or 7th century story BCE depicting the Lord, well, according to this author, the Lord in this scenario is heavily an anthropomorphic figure who represents probably our Baal-berith, our Mesopotamian overlord. But other than the one instance where he takes the role of Baal, the storm and weather god, with raining fire from above, but he is still referred to in the same name as Lord. But we should assume that this author, or authors for Genesis 12 to 25, meant the same thing. A powerful king that has the power of a god, such as El and Baal from the Ugaritic texts. Now, coincidentally, folks, the famous Assyrian king, Ashurbanipal, who reigned from 669 to 631 B.C., well, he was the last of the great kings of Assyria, and his name literally means the god Ashur. And he is mentioned in the Tanakh as well as Ezra 4:19. Now, Ashurbanipal proved himself worthy of protecting his people through a display of great strength, such as hunting lions. Now, like many rulers of the ancient world, he liked to boast about his victories in battle and brutally crushed his enemies. However, this vast and diverse empire, it was controlled through more than just one brute force. Ashurbanipal used his skills as a scholar, even a diplomat, and a strategist to become one of the Assyria's greatest rulers of all of time. So, guys, it would make sense this editor, this scribe, this author writing for Genesis, and especially Job, compare their Lord to one of the greatest leaders during his time. Now the goal here, folks, is to verify and confirm that the Abrahamic narrative in Genesis does in fact support a secular interpretation, and at what level it does. So I think it's necessary to revisit some of the text while viewing the anthropomorphic figure as a foreign ruler who would be in the same league with the kings of the East, such as Ashurmenapah. And this immaterial one, simply as a local deity, matched up to the king, such as El-Berith. So as we do this little exercise, guys, we have to disregard the use of the term Yahweh and Elohim. Because if these terms were genuinely meant to refer to one and the same entity, like Wellhausen suggests, then their substitutions should not affect the dynamic of the story or its deep narrative structure. Furthermore, the substitutions should bear absolutely no impact to the dynamic of the story whatsoever. And naturally, we should question whether or not the anthropomorphic nature of Yahweh necessarily refers to a mortal figure in the story, as the figure in Job. Now, of course, it could also be evidence for separate sources and writers, where one is referring to Yahweh as an anthropomorphic deity and the other as an immaterial one, as suspected by Wellhausen, right? But it was also undoubtedly quite common in antiquity to portray gods with anthropomorphic features. And Greek mythology is loaded with these kinds of examples. However, the only difference is, in Greek mythology, the stories don't hold up when humans replace the gods because their deeds remain eminently fantastic and mostly allegorical. And this is exactly why Zeus despite his anthropomorphic characteristics, he has to be a god so that the attributes bestowed upon him are coherent with the story that's being told. Now, a parallel can be drawn with immaterial Elohim, because this figure cannot take on a human form, a human dimension, without the entire story's integrity falling apart like a cheap suit. We therefore need to look for the emergence of a new dimension, induced by the possible human presence. Now for this exegesis, we need to talk about Genesis chapters 12 through 25, 13 chapters, while 1, ignoring all the names that are in place, provided by the editors and the scribes over hundreds of years, and instead, identifying and dissociating anthropomorphic from the immaterial one in the text. And 2, picturing the anthropomorphic figure in the story as a powerful Mesopotamian overlord in league with the four eastern kings, and the immaterial one as a local deity and or dead kin. And 3, folks, identifying and then removing the obvious redaction layers that just don't fit the context of a secular covenant with a mortal overlord. And these are all anecdotal elements such as glosses, commentaries, and periscopes, and even entire chapters that contain like supernatural ghostly elements that just don't contribute at all to the main plot. And 4, inserting where appropriate, the translation or transliteration of the original Hebraic text that best fits the context. Chronologies and dating are also corrected, from a failed sexagesimal to decimal conversion by the scribes and editors over hundreds of years, which is a whole other subject to talk about another time. But ultimately, this conversion made people hundreds of years old in the story, hundreds of years older than they actually were. So, because of this, I will never use Bible dating guides when talking about any character in the narrative, and especially the king, Abraham, and Sarah. Now, these few steps alone, guys, they're going to help us expose a political plot and a naturalistic interpretation that will help the reader or the listener here filter out some of the remnant crap, which is the result from just the additions of redaction layers over hundreds of years. So the following rendition of the biblical text distinguishes between the anthropomorphic figure, systematically referred to as the Lord or Baal Berith, and the immaterial figure, referred to as Elohim, Eloi, El Shaddai, or El Elyon, as per the Masoretic text. Now the story begins with a journey to Canaan. Now, in the story, Abraham's name is actually Abram. It doesn't change until he meets this new mysterious Lord. Now, Abram's story, it begins when his father, Terah, leaves Mesopotamia to go to Haran in Syria. Genesis 11:31 reads like this. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran, and there they dwelt. Now at this point in the story, there is no mention of an alliance with anyone per se, but Abraham is promised more of a brightful future. He's promised that he would have a great name and a great nation that will be his and his people's. Now, the enigmatic opening of chapter 12, it kind of poses a little bit of a challenge for us, or it opens up for some questions just about where did these two guys meet, being Abraham and this Lord, because it's really unclear how they met before their engagement on the battlefield. Now, perhaps it just didn't matter to the authors at the time, and it was just understood as common knowledge. But the passage highlights that, although not knowing, how the introductions began between the king or God, with, quotations in my head, and Abram. But the blessings and the curses expressed in these conversations are in fact identical to contractual language of those found in the ancient Near East treaties, such as the agreements found between Hammurabi and smaller kingdoms for support. Also, the concept of preserving one's name was crucial in the ancient Near Eastern culture. Why? Because it was closely tied to ancestor worship, which led to inheritance, possession of the land, right? That was really key. Therefore, by promising Abraham that his name will be great, the redactor is suggesting the promise of descendants and the land inherited. It's also necessary to take into account the political context when examining the promise that's mentioned in the previous paragraph. Because in his extensive analysis of the promise, scholar and author Baden makes a clever and relevant observation when he stresses that the term nation implies political context, which is precisely what we're exploring in this interpretation. And this is what he says. The Hebrew word for nation here is goy, which connotes specifically the political aspect of nationhood in contrast to kinship term am, which is people. So this political term here is not only found in Genesis 12:2, but it's also throughout all the text regarding the promise. We call it the promise text. And it's also found in Genesis 17:4-6. Chapter 16, chapter 20, chapter 18, verse 17, chapter 21, verse 13, chapter 18, chapter 35, 11, and 46, 3. And we also clearly find the term king as being used in the context of the promise as well, as in Genesis 17, 6, chapter 16, and 35, 11. Now, these findings don't solely apply to the context of an earthly covenant per se, but they most definitely set the right stage for it. And in many cases, folks, these verses might have been introduced as a theological device, or because a tablet was perhaps damaged and a well-intentioned redactor may have tried to put things back together again at a later time. But since these verses clearly aren't the original works and the only surviving works that we have of centuries of redaction and editing, well, we have to reinterpret the verses in order to see what the terms, or which terms, would have worked better. So let's pick up at Genesis 12:4. So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old. Now, in reality, this is the last time I'm going to correct this. He was 45 once the decimal system was corrected, as I talked about before. But he was 45 years old when he departed out of Haran. Now, the most logical explanation for this reference to the Lord is that it was added from a later philosophy, or perhaps a theology, and as an explanatory gloss, because it follows Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. Now, note that the corrected chronology also suggests that Abram would have been 45 years old, rather than the 75 years old that the author put in, at the time that he entered Canaan. Now, Genesis 12:5 reads, And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. Then in Genesis 12:6 we get this, And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shittim, unto the plain of Morah, and the Canaanites were in the land. Now, in their book, The Bible Unearthed, archaeologists Israel Finkelstein and Neil Asher Silberman mention a 19th century BCE Egyptian carving that describes the deeds of a general named Kusabek, and it provides evidence for the existence of the land of Shechem and Hebron, which were two major settlements where Abram is said to have lived and would have become home to the biblical patriarchs. Now, we've talked about Shechem a lot, so I don't think I need to go back and reiterate any of that kind of stuff. But Finkelstein and Silberman both confirm that Shechem was already the economic and political center of a vast region that would later become the birthplace of Israel. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 7, And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed I will give this land, And there he built an altar unto the Lord, who appeared to him. Now, despite the anthropomorphic portrayal of the Lord in this verse, its redaction appears to have been primarily focused on the foretelling of the promise of the gift of the land. And it is reiterated also in Genesis 15, as well as Genesis 17. Now, the redactor probably expanded on the original reference to the altar, which is a legitimate detail, given that Abraham is described as building altars elsewhere in the story when he arrives at the new place, the new home, the land of milk and honey. But altars in ancient times were often very simple structures too, just made out of readily available materials such as stone, dirt, and clay, just kind of formed up into what could be like a sacrificial place. Now, the primary purpose of these altars was most likely used for the ancient patriarchs of the burnt sacrifice, the Ola sacrifice. Remember? Sounds like hello in Spanish. And it also is used for offerings, and worship, and prayer. Now, this was a customary practice in the ancient Near East, and it would not have been unusual for Abraham to follow this practice as he traveled through different territories as a Hiburu. Now, given the dangerous nature of these trade routes, caravans being constantly under attack by pirates, booty pirates, sodomizing pirates, I don't know about that part, but it would also make sense that Abram was also invoking the memory of his dead kin for protection and looking for a good future, looking for guidance. Especially if this dead kin was known for protecting people, protecting his family, and providing a safe passage along these trade routes. Like what we just talked about in the book of Job, the opening chapter. Because traveling in ancient times, guys, it was a dangerous business. And people often turned to their gods or their ancestors for help and guidance along the way. Now, this Lord had to remind Job that he would lose everything, including his family, including all of his livestock, to Satan if he did not trust in him. Now, sacrifices and offerings were often and always made in exchange for this type of protection. And altars served as a physical space for these rituals to take place. Because in Genesis 12, verse 8, we get this. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent there, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he built an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. After moving some more south, Abram then builds another altar to invoke his Elohim. And then in Genesis 12:9, and Abram journeyed, going on still towards the south. Now at this point in the story, Abram's nephew Lot, he decides to settle near Sodom because he likes that kind of thing. And a severe drought in Canaan forces Abram to pack up his family and all of their shit, and move further south and settle in the fertile region of the Delta for some time. Now, in the story, it was also revealed that Abram was a wealthy man, king of the Hiburu, perhaps, a ruler, a regional king, and that Sarai was still a beautiful woman. Sarai is Sarah, obviously. And she's also capable of arousing envy. That's right. She can still get a little action in her guy. Because according to Genesis 12:10, we get this. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass, when he was near to enter the land of Egypt, that he said unto his wife Sarai, Behold now, I know thou art a fair woman to look upon. Now, I think he's picking up and making some motions on his wife. But according to biblical chronology, well, Sarai would have been 65 years old when she entered the land of Canaan, but that just can't be right. Therefore, she's still considered a fair woman to look upon in the ancient world. Well, it's more than likely that she's probably younger. In fact, she would have been possibly sometime in her 30s when the correct math is applied. The story continues in Genesis 12:12. Therefore it shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see thee, being Sarai, that they shall say, this is his wife. And Abraham thinks to himself, and they will kill me, but they will save my wife Sarai. So apparently, Abraham's a little concerned here. In the original recorded text, that the Egyptians were getting all aroused, and they were going to kill him in order to take his wife for themselves. And then in the next verse, 13, we get this. Abraham says, say, I pray to you, this is my sister, not my wife, and that it may be well with me for my sake, that my soul shall live on because of her. And it came to pass that when Abram came into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, his wife, that she was hot, that she was really sexy, that she was very fair. Obviously, I added some of that stuff in there, but you get the picture. So now Abram confirms that the Egyptians have their eyes on his wife, and so he proclaims her to be his sister instead. Now, guys, sticky. Ladies, slippery. Because in Genesis 12:15, we learn some things here, because the story moves on. Genesis 12:15, the princes also of the Pharaoh, they saw her Sarai, and commanded her to stand before the Pharaoh. And the woman Sarai was taken into the Pharaoh's palace, while Abraham is waiting outside. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty sure Abraham's completely losing his shit. But we do understand in the story that we find out that Abraham's loaded. His wallet's fat with cash, credit cards. Because we get this. And he, the Pharaoh, entreated Abraham. Entreated means requesting something from him, like quite anxiously. Entreated Abraham well for her sake. And Abraham, he had sheep. He had oxen. He had he-asses. He had manservants and maidservants and she-asses and camels. So basically, our man Abe here, he rolled into Egypt with a hot wife and an entourage of servants and cattle. Now, I also want to point out that it's super important to realize that this was actually quite normal. It was a customary tradition for leaders and rulers and kings to trade a daughter or a sister with each other whenever establishing a peace treaty or a covenant and negotiating a contract. Now, these agreements included men's wives, since they were always considered property at the time, right? And some were hostages, and other times they were slaves. But these women helped minimize the risk of betrayal by ensuring that both parties literally had skin in the game, which is a tradition that still exists today in many cultures. So in reality, if our hero Abraham here had presented Sarai as his wife to the Pharaoh instead of his sister, then the Pharaoh would not have been able to reciprocate the deal, putting Abraham into a very uncertain situation, or a dangerous position, but potential quagmire. Anyway, but it's also very likely, guys, that the slave woman in the story, Hagar, was also acquired as part of this alliance. Now see in Genesis 12, verse 17. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now it was common practice, guys, to invoke deities as witnesses whenever entering into a treaty or a covenant or a contract. Just like we saw with the Baal of Tyre, invoking the gods to oversee the treaty and to condemn anybody who fails to uphold their end. Now, in theory, if either party of this agreement failed to uphold their end of the obligation, whatever it might be, they would be subjected to curses and other form of divine punishment. And we saw this in early Jewish literature, such as Jonah 1, where basically Yahweh just destroys and blows up Jonah's ship on the ocean, just to demonstrate what would happen if he failed to uphold his end of the bargain. Also invoking the storm god Baal, where Baal is attested as a divine witness in the Treaty of Esarhaddon with the Baal of Tyre, and also at Ugarit, as well as the Egyptian Hittite treaties. We also have an Akkadian version of that same text from Ugarit that we call RS 20.24, that basically lists the storm god 6 times after the weather god called Lord of Mount Hazai. Now, similarly, in the treaty between Ramesses II and the Hittite king Hattusilis, the divine witness includes both Seth, who would be Baal, or Lord of the Sky, and Seth of the various towns. Now, it's important to keep in mind, guys, that the storm gods, with the name Baal, were invoked in one way or another as the divine witness to contracts and agreements between major kings and rulers, especially up and down those trade routes. And notice the geography of this practice, and where Abraham is currently making this deal, this covenant with the king. Now, evidently, after Abraham's Lord had a speaking to, or a few words with the Pharaoh, and he decided to change his mind a little bit, well, we get this in Genesis 12:18, and it says, "And the Pharaoh called Abraham and said, 'What is this that you have done unto me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say that she was your sister, so I might have taken her to be my wife? Now therefore, behold, take your wife, get her out of here, and go away.'" Now likewise, in Hammurabi's Code of Laws, which dates back sometime to the Middle Bronze Age, it prescribes the death penalty for the offense of adultery. And here's what it says. "If a man's wife be surprised with another man, both shall be tied and thrown into the ocean. But the husband may pardon his wife, and the king his slaves." Now, Egypt also had its own laws that condemned adultery, which more than likely influenced the behavior of the Pharaoh mentioned in this narrative. Because in Genesis 12:20, it says this, "And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had." And then in Genesis 13:1, it moves on. "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold." So we're turning Bible 101 upside down onto its head, guys. Because the fact that Abram was able to make this treaty, this agreement, this covenant with this Pharaoh, well, it suggests that he was a wealthy and influential person. Abram was a herdsman of all herdsmen, with a very large following and support. Now, on the other hand, commoners, regular old people, during that time period would not have had the luxury to make a deal, or the social status, or the economic needs in order to negotiate treaties with rulers like this. They would have been killed on the spot or just sent to go work in the mines. Genesis 13:3 continues, "And he went on his journey from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been in the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place where he built the altar, which he had made there first. And there Abram called on the name of his Lord," using the word Elohim. Abram then traveled back between Bethel and Hai, and there he invoked his ancestral deity, Elohim. And Genesis 13:5, "And Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together. For their substances were so great, so that they could not dwell together." So basically what this author is saying is between Abraham and Lot, they evidently had so many flocks and so many workers, the land just could not tolerate the two of them in the same proximity. So Lot had to move on and relocate.
and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled there in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray to thee, between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdsmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? So separate thyself, I pray to thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right, then I will depart to the left.
So evidently, due to the sizable herds owned by both Lot and Abram, well, they required a shitload of land. They required an abundance of pastures just in order to feed their massive flocks. Also, in order to avoid any conflict over resources in general. So it seems that our man Abram here basically offers to separate himself from Lot in order to allow him to choose any land that he desires under the jurisdiction that Abraham's Lord gave to them. Because in Genesis 13:10, it reads like this.
And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plains of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar.
Now this biblical verse here, it actually unveils something super interesting to us. Because this biblical verse implies that during the Bronze Age period, sometime between 2000 and 1200 BCE, there was abundant fresh water and lush vegetation everywhere, especially in the vicinity of biblical Sodom for the flocks and for the cattle to graze in order to survive. So if the Lord who is mentioned in these verses is indeed our Mesopotamian overlord, as some scholars believe anyway, then the phrase, even as the garden of the Lord, it could be a reference to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Now, while the Gardens of Babylon were not officially recognized as one of the seven wonders of the world until sometime later, it is likely, however, that Babylon already had impressive gardens thanks to the sophisticated canal system built during the time of Hammurabi. But because when Hammurabi established control over the whole region of Mesopotamia, that was right around, 1760 BCE, and especially the city-states of Sumeria, he restored the irrigation canals there to their best conditions possible, and ultimately brought water back to the areas of the south that were previously deprived of it. So his unification of the entire south and the lands north of Babylon allowed him to dig long trenches and canals through the various cities of these lands. Now, interestingly enough, in Hammurabi's Code of Laws, it also included some provisions that addressed the misuse of water. Kind of like what I get and probably you get every summer from the water company, telling me that I can only water my lawn once a week until it turns brown and dies. I digress. But this code indicates that water management and conservation were important issues in ancient societies, and that laws had to be established in order to regulate water usage to prevent abuse. Abuse from guys like me who enjoy a green lawn in August and take long showers and wash my car. But if anyone opens their reservoirs to water their crops and maybe had a couple of beers while cutting the grass and accidentally maybe just flooded his crops and maybe even the crops of his neighbors, then he would be liable to pay the neighbor for damages. So you can actually thank Hammurabi for those high water bills during the summer months. So if another man lets water in to take care of his crops, and the water just happens to overflow into his neighbor's plantation, then he would have to pay 10 gur of corn for every 10 gan of land. So when given the choice, folks, Lot selects what appears to be the more desirable location on the map to set up a settlement and call home. Now in Genesis 13:11, it says this.
Then Lot chose him all the plains of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves one from the other. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly.
Now it kind of makes you wonder why Lot in the first place would want to set up a house and farm in the land of wickedness and sin. I mean, if the people of Sodom were so bad and were known for being evil, why would Lot want this location? Now, I go back and tell Abraham that, hey, man, I'm changing my mind. You take Sodom instead. So in Genesis 13:14, we get this.
And the Lord said unto Abraham, after Lot was separated from him, Lift up thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest, to thee I will give, and to your seed forever. And I will make thy seed the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto you.
Now this is important, folks, because these verses share that conversation that Abraham was having with his Lord. That if you agree to this covenant, with this treaty, with this agreement, that all things will belong to you. Everything that you can see to the north, to the west, to the south, to the east, it belongs to you. These borders, including the trade routes. Now this, of course, is all the dialogue that's happening before the actual covenant takes place. So this is probably the very original in its context of a very wealthy herdsman, the king of the Habiru, and another king, the king of Mesopotamia, discussing the possibilities of a partnership. Protecting the king's caravans on the trade routes, and in return, it's simple, this land is yours, and I will help you protect your borders. And then the story continues in Genesis 13:18.
Then Abram removed his tent, and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron. And there he built an altar unto his Lord, Elohim, or El Barith.
Now, keeping in this tradition, Abram constructed a new altar to his king once he arrived at his new destination. Okay, guys, I'm going to call the episode here. This is going to be part one of To Be Done with Sodom. So actually, this episode's going to be called On the Road to Sodom, or as Kyle, listener Kyle, wants me to call it, On the Road to Sodomy. Laugh out loud. Okay, there you got it, buddy. But anyway, I am going to be going on vacation next week and going to Portugal, as I had mentioned to some of you before. I'm gone from the 4th to the 16th, and then I will be coming back and commence recording the second half of this, which will include the sacking of Sodom by this overlord and why, and the ultimate reasoning behind this covenant that Abraham is having with this Mesopotamian overlord, or to some of you folks, God. So anyway, I think this is a good place to stop. It basically got us all the way up into where Lot and Abram separated, the involvement with the Egyptian pharaoh. We talked about some of the dating in the system of these people, that they're not 600 years old, that they're more like 60 years old. So I think this is a good place to stop. I think I got us up to where Lot has moved into Sodom, and quite strange that he would move on to Sodom, especially if it's such a place of such great sin and evil. This is key. So when we come back and start talking about To Be Done with Sodom and the sacking of Sodom, it's going to make a lot more sense why the biblical narrative kind of paints a picture of sin and evil and corruption, and ultimately Christians referring to gay people as sodomites.
It's going to be a good episode. Anyway, folks, have a great few weeks here. I'm going to be enjoying some time, beautiful weather, out on the beaches, enjoying port wine in Porto and all the offerings of Lisbon. And if you follow me on Instagram or X or Facebook or anything like that, I'll be posting some pictures and updates. Meanwhile, please feel free to reach out to me and let's talk about this stuff. Go to the Facebook group page and let's have conversations because this is a great episode and it should really get your thoughts going, definitely provoking some great ideas. All right, guys, take care. Love you. Be good humans.